This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning, June 21st. And we're finally getting some great weather out there, and I hope people are having an opportunity to get out and enjoy it and to perform some exercise, walk, and kind of enjoy nature to some degree. Today, my guest is going to be Dr. Asher Qureshi. We had a request from one of our listeners to talk about sleep apnea, so I was able to arrange to have Dr. Qureshi join us today. He's a pulmonologist specializing in sleep disorders at Trinity Health of New England, and specifically he is the director of sleep disorders at St. Francis Hospital. This is an exciting field of medicine, and it's changing a great deal in terms of devices used for sleep apnea, how you evaluate somebody, how do you know you have sleep apnea or another sleep disorder. So we're going to talk about sleep disorders in general, as well as focusing in on sleep apnea. So I'm looking forward to that conversation at 11:20. As always on this program, we'd like to commemorate this day in medicine. June 21st, 1880 was when Dr. Arnold Gessel was born. Dr. Gessel was an American pediatrician and a psychologist, and he pioneered infant developmental assessment. And he is referred to as the father of developmental pediatrics. He was a professor at Yale, so he was local to us here, and really looked at these assessments early on. I mean, he was born in 1880 and really got into looking and assessing an infant and pediatric patients in terms of their development. You know, how we use all those different charts and things, where they are on what scale. Those were developed early on by Dr. Gessel. You know, one of the things that we talk about a lot here is this healthcare apocalypse we're faced with now, and you can't help but notice that it's in the news all the time. And specifically, the three things that can end our world. I mean, that's how severe it's become: infection, climate, and nuclear disaster. Well, we talk about infection a lot, and we're going to be talking about a little bit more today. Climate is becoming apparent. Right? This climate is changing, and the reason we know that is because we keep seeing these record highs, okay, in temperature, where you can't turn the television on or listen to the radio to hear about record flooding in West Virginia, people getting carried away by floods in this country, and really throughout the world. So we know the climate is changing. But I didn't think we'd get this soon in our history, in our development, to start talking about nuclear disaster. Well, we've been talking about it since the 1960s. But right now, we're in the midst of a conversation with Iran that may or may not have a nuclear weapon and may or may not be willing to use it. And you have to ask yourself, boy, the stakes could not be higher right at this point in time. And it's important to have leadership that understands this and is willing to work. You know, dialogue, I learned from my friend Father Rick, who's in Haiti, dealing with, I don't know what other word to use it, terrorists who on a daily basis are really out there capturing people and taking kidnappings and things like that. And he said the only tool he really has is dialogue. is opening a dialogue, even with these despicable people who perform these despicable acts. You need to have a dialogue because that is the only weapon that can be useful in this situation. And again, I think we need to keep that in mind as our leaders talk about nuclear weapons and the use of nuclear weapons. The measles, let's talk about it. It's really changed. The picture is now changed. The measles cases are now in 34 of our 50 states, and North Dakota is now the focus of that. Now, previously, the epicenter was West Texas. We talked about a place called Gaines, Texas, where this all started by a group of Mennonites who believed that vaccination was harmful. Well, what's happening in West Texas is the numbers are subsiding because these previously hesitant residents have become all too aware of the reality setting in that measles can be deadly, can be harmful to their children, and it is avoidable. So more people are willing to get vaccinated now in West Texas, so their numbers are coming down. But that's not the case in North Dakota, where the numbers are going up. And, you know, the reality here is we need to work to overcome this vaccine misinformation that's out there in some areas. And despite this purge of experts from decision-making roles in the Trump administration, most notably Robert F. Kennedy, and these people touting this misinformation. And that's the only way we're going to get control of it. And hopefully people will start to see that, as the people have seen in West Texas. Now, we've talked about this before. So Robert F. Kennedy, the least qualified person in this country to head, to be the lead health officer for our country, fired the entire committee for the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices. Fired the whole committee, 17 members. And now he has started to recreate that committee and named 8 new replacements. And he said the purpose is to reassess longstanding vaccination recommendations. So the first person he puts on there is a nurse named Vicki Pebsworth. She's the regional director for the National Association of Catholic Nurses. She's also a member of the National Vaccine Information Center. This is a group that is widely considered to be the leading source of vaccine misinformation. So let's put her in a federal leadership role. Then we have Dr. Robert Malone. Dr. Malone runs a wellness institute and a popular blog. Now, he is an interesting character because he rose to prominence during the COVID-19 pandemic, and he relayed these conspiracy theories around the outbreak and the vaccines that followed. Now, his famous claim is that millions of Americans were hypnotized into taking the COVID-19 shots and suggested that those vaccines cause a form of AIDS. He then downplayed the deaths related to the outbreaks in the U.S. So here's another, I don't even know how to describe these people, but now he is in a leadership role. The guy who's claimed that we were all hypnotized into taking the vaccine. Then we've got Dr. Martin Kulldorff. Dr. Kulldorff is a biostatistician who co-authored the Great Barrington Declaration. You'll remember that. That was back in October 2020. And maintained that the pandemic shutdowns were causing irreparable harm to everyone. So this gives you a sampling of the people that are now leading the vaccine guidance, the advice that he is seeking out and this administration is seeking out. And I want to remind everybody that when Robert F. Kennedy sat in front of the Senate during his confirmation hearings, right, he promised he would not change the vaccination schedule. But less than a week later, after he got approved, he vowed to investigate childhood vaccines and prevent measles, polio, and other dangerous diseases. I don't know what to say to those senators, except I've got a bridge for you for sale. I mean, I don't know how they got taken to the cleaners on this deal. I want to do a little follow-up on the conversation we had with Dr. Lin about fluoride. And it was an interesting article that I read in follow-up. And really, in terms of what's going to happen, without fluoride in the water, we're now looking at billions of added dental bills and millions of new cavities for young people. And the researchers at Brigham and Women's Hospital really did a lot of looking at this and really analyzed survey data from 8,484 children looking at this. And it looks like it's going to cost us about $9.8 billion in the first 5 years if we continue to ban fluoride in water. You know, it's been 80 years. I know Dr. Lin mentioned maybe 50 years, but I didn't realize the first study that she referred to was done 80 years ago in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And it became the first U.S. city to fluoridate its drinking water. And by 1980, half of the U.S. population was drinking water with fluoride because it's a practical and cost-effective way, and it's equitable for all communities to promote good health. And those were based on the studies done where they found fluoride in people's wells, and they had better dental care, their teeth developed better, and they had fewer problems with that. Another problem we're rapidly coming up on, and actually we're in the midst of, is, and I wanted to talk about this, and this is the Trump travel restrictions barring residents needed at U.S. hospitals. So if you've ever been in a hospital, you'll know that there are a lot of physicians there who are foreign-born and foreign-educated. And that is because we don't produce enough physicians in this country. So with that, you have to make it clear that we are running at a shortage. So on May 27th, the government suspended the interview appointments for physicians needing J-1 visas. And these are the visas used for cultural exchanges. And so they couldn't get their interviews done to get here for July 1st to take over their role as residents, interns and residents and fellows. They lifted the ban this past Wednesday on June 18th, but now they want enhanced social media vetting of these people. Now, let me explain that these physicians are the best and the brightest of their countries. I have worked with them, I continue to work with them, and they are among the brightest physicians. Now we are going through this vetting process, but we also have a travel ban. Right, so there's a travel ban in this country from 19 countries, soon to be 36 countries. Now, the statistics are interesting because 20% of all U.S. physicians were born and educated overseas. One-fifth of all physicians. In 2024, the Educational Commission for Foreign Medical Graduates sponsored 15,500 physicians from 150 countries to fill residency spots in 770 hospitals. What happens with these physicians? So after they complete their training, they have a J-1 visa, they have the opportunity to take their knowledge, their specialty that they've developed here, and go to an underserved area of this country to serve our citizens. And what's happened historically, and this has been going on for many years, they have become part of the community and stayed in these communities and served these communities well in specialties like cardiology, nephrology, pulmonology. So banning these visas and cutting back on these visas are an important move and affect the health of all of us. And specifically here in Connecticut, At UConn, we still have 9 people who may not be able to start their residency. That's the number I got this week when I looked at this. So we think most have been cleared. We still don't know, but there are still 9 people who probably won't be able to start their internship and residency. You might say, well, it's only 9. 9 is a lot. When you're taking night call and when you're a patient lying there, don't forget, the first physician you're going to see is probably a resident. And they're the one you're going to see the most if you're an inpatient. So we need to take that to heart. Also, I want to say I previously said Robert F. Kennedy, and I meant Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I certainly do not want to besmirch the career of RFK, who was a great leader in this country in the 1960s, but something went wrong with his offspring, at least as far as RFK Jr. is concerned. With that, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Asher Qureshi. We're talking about pulmonary disease. If you have a question for me, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com. That's info@alessimd.com if you have any live questions about sleep apnea for Dr. Qureshi. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And it gives me great pleasure to have as my guest today, Dr. Asher Qureshi. Dr. Qureshi is a pulmonologist specializing in sleep disorders at Trinity Health of New England, and specifically at St. Francis Hospital. Asher, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Tony. Thank you. I'm happy to be on the show with you.
Let's talk a little bit. We have a few minutes, and sorry, I went a little bit over than expected, but let's talk a little bit about overall, what are some common sleep disorders, and really, how does pulmonary medicine relate to sleep?
So pulmonary and sleep is a two-way street. They both affect each other. If you have bad lung disease, it's going to affect your ability to sleep at night. You'll be disturbed at night, which will in turn affect your daytime function. Sleep apnea is one of the conditions that affects a lot of people here. And that has a reciprocal relationship with both asthma and COPD. It can worsen the control of COPD and asthma because of it generates a lot of free radicals when you're sleeping at night and having low oxygen levels. So some of the common sleep disorders that we deal with in our sleep clinic at Trinity Health of New England and St. Francis are sleep apnea, which is a condition where you stop breathing at night. We deal with insomnia, which is an inability to sleep. A lot of people have difficulty falling asleep or maintaining sleep, and especially during the COVID epidemic, there was a surge of insomnia, different reasons for that, including stress. Then we deal with the abnormal behaviors in sleep. We call them parasomnias, where you can have things like walking or talking in your sleep or acting out your dreams. Another thing we deal with is movement disorders in sleep, like restless legs or limb movement disorder, where you kick in your sleep or can't fall asleep because of uncomfortable sensations in your legs. A smaller percentage is probably circadian disorders, where we have misaligned with our sleep schedule, so we don't go to bed at the right time.
How does someone know that they have a sleep disorder? I mean, I granted insomnia and things such as that, but when someone needs a sleep study, for example, with sleep apnea, how would someone know, hey, I got to get in touch with Dr. Qureshi?
So a lot of times it's the spouse who reaches out to me because they can't sleep with the snoring that's going on when somebody has sleep apnea. Things that people can complain of, if they have pretty severe sleep apnea, they may wake up choking and gasping at night. Universally across the board, all of these people are usually unrefreshed in the morning. They have non-restorative sleep. They feel sleepy and tired despite sleeping for 7-8 hours. They may take naps during the daytime. They may have poor concentration. They may have issues with a dry mouth or a dry throat because they're snoring all night long and everything gets dried. They have a sore throat in the morning when they wake up.
So with that, and typically someone would go to their primary care physician, I assume, and get a referral over to you.
That's the most common route.
Okay. Well, listen, we're going to take a short break, and then I want to get back. We're going to talk a little bit more specifically about sleep apnea and really some of the devices available. We all see these ads for Inspire We know there are a variety of masks. So there are a lot of changes for the treatment of sleep apnea and the importance of treating sleep apnea. We're also going to talk a little bit about excessive daytime somnolence. And Dr. Qureshi has agreed to talk about one of my pet peeves. Why do we change our clocks to daylight saving time? If you have any questions, you could reach me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with my guest today, Dr. Asher Qureshi. And we're talking about sleep disorders, and he is a pulmonologist. So let's talk a little bit about sleep apnea itself. Can you tell us what is it, and who are the people who are most prone to having sleep apnea?
So sleep apnea is a disorder which happens when you're sleeping at night. When you're sleeping, your tone in the muscle goes low, and you start collapsing your airway. If it's a partial collapse, you may just snore. If it's a complete collapse, the airway just stops for a few seconds to a minute, and your oxygen levels drop down. When they go down, your oxygen levels will make your brain go into a panic that it's not getting enough oxygen, and that wakes you up by putting a lot of adrenaline in your system. So this is a cycle which happens sometimes 10, 15 times an hour, sometimes 100 times per hour for people, depending upon the severity. So primarily is the collapse in the airway, which is causing you to have sleep apnea. The people who are at risk for sleep apnea are those who are either heavy, so they have a lot of tissue deposited in the back of their throat and the airway is narrow, or they have a congenital problem in the airway where the airway is narrow. Sometimes it's genetic, the way your parents look. If they have a narrow pharynx, big tongue, you may have the same features too, which put you at a risk of having a collapse at night when you're sleeping.
So how do we know that? Let's talk about the sleep study, because I guess that's where you really make your diagnosis. Can we talk a little bit about what a sleep study entails and what you're looking at?
So there's different ways of doing a sleep study. The gold standard in the past was an in-lab study where we used to bring people into the sleep lab. We put you in a bed, we videotape you, we put monitors in your brain to see when you're awake and when you're sleeping. We put monitors around your nose and your mouth to see when you're breathing and when you're stopping breathing. We check your oxygen levels. We do an EKG on you to look at your heart rate and your rhythm. We have movement monitors on you to see if you move around in your sleep. We have monitors on your chin and your legs to see how the tone is in your body. All these things look at when you go into sleep, what kind of sleep do you have, and what kind of breathing events or arrhythmias do you have. You can even pick up seizures with these devices too. It's usually done in a sleep lab. It's an overnight study. You come in at night at 8 to 9, and you wake up in the morning. Whenever you do 5, 6, the study is over. A technician will monitor you. The good part is if anything comes off during the study, the technician can go in and put those monitors back on. And we also have the ability to intervene. If somebody is stopping breathing hundreds of times in the first 2 hours, we can put them on a CPAP machine or a treatment and see what that response is to do the diagnosis as well as the treatment plan for them. There was a limited number of sleep centers available in the United States, and that's still a problem now. So because of that, we looked into other options which were more portable, and these are called home sleep studies. And what these are looking at is primarily whether you're stopping breathing at night and what your oxygen levels are and what your heart rate monitors are doing. This can be done as a regular HST. There's also things like WatchPath, which look at your oxygen levels and your tone in the artery to translate into breathing events. These can be done at home. They're usually done by the patient. The con is that if something comes off during the night, you may have wasted the whole night for the study. If you put it on right, we can get the results in the comfort of your home. You mail back the device to us, and there are even portable monitors which can be disposable. So you don't have to send anything back. It automatically connects in the morning and downloads the data to the sleep center.
Do most people get them done at home or go to a sleep lab now?
Most of our patients are now getting sleep studies at home, but we do still want certain people to come into the hospital to have these studies done. So these will be people who've got advanced lung disease or heart disease, people who are on oxygen, who we would not want to take the oxygen off at night in the home. We need to do that in the hospital setting where somebody can watch them. Other things like seizures or abnormal behaviors in your sleep or evaluation of narcolepsy, those things cannot be done at home adequately. Those still need to come to the hospital, to a sleep lab center, to have those tests done.
How long does a study take? Is it just one overnight, or from that standpoint, with all the wires hooked up, and when you go to the lab?
Yeah, 99% of the time, we can get the results in one night. With the home test, depending upon how the device is put on and how uncomfortable or restless the patient is, if something comes off, we can miss the diagnosis. So some of the sleep labs tell the patients to do the home study for two nights instead of one night to get the results. But primarily, one night is usually enough to give you enough data to make the diagnosis or clear you from sleep apnea.
Okay, so you've now made a diagnosis of sleep apnea in somebody. What's the next step in treatment? And I guess specifically my question was, I remember when they used to do surgery for this. Do people still do surgery for sleep apnea?
It has become pretty rare now that people go for the big-time surgeries that we used to do before. The smaller surgeries, which just dealt with the ULO, palatopharyngoplasty, or UPPP, yeah, they didn't work as well. So the response rate was only 50%, and the improvement was not lasting. If you gained weight, you tended to see get the sleep apnea back. It did make you quiet, though, because you're not snoring. We have cut out the palate, which is what makes you snore at night. Advanced surgeries like maxillomandibular advancement are very detailed surgeries where we are breaking the jaw, we are restructuring your face, and those are reserved more for younger people who really want to go all the way. Still, at this point in time, the gold standard for sleep apnea treatment is a CPAP machine, which is a CPAP, which is like a vacuum hooked in reverse, which blows air with high pressure into the back of your throat. It opens up the airway so you don't collapse. People who cannot tolerate the CPAP, various reasons, claustrophobic, can't tolerate the machine, get too dried out, social pressures, they can go for things like oral appliances, which is a device which pulls the lower jaw forward and keeps the tongue from collapsing. They usually work for mild to moderate, but in rescue cases, we have used them in severe patients too. Now, recently, maybe 10, 15 years ago, they came up with this device, the Inspire. So basically, Inspire device is a stimulator for the hypoglossal nerve. Hypoglossal nerve supplies the tongue muscle. So when you protrude your tongue out, that's what the hypoglossal nerve is doing, is making you stick your tongue out. So they came up with this device which you implant into your chest. It has got a sensor which they put into the respiratory muscles, which senses when you're breathing. And there's an effector lead which they tunnel through the chest into the neck, into the base of the tongue, and they apply it to the hypoglossal nerve. So when you turn it on, it's a device that you turn on at night when you're about to sleep. It stimulates the tongue whenever it feels that you're breathing at night, so it creates more space in the back of your throat, preventing the collapse. It's a process. You have to be qualified for this kind of a device. Not everybody is a good candidate for this. So the thing that they look at is how heavy you are. Initially, when the study was done for this kind of a device, they looked for people who had a BMI, height-weight ratio of 33 or lower. They have become more liberal in this. They're going up to 40 to 60 BMI now on a case-by-case basis. The other thing they looked at was how severe was the sleep apnea. Upper limit right now is 100 events per hour. Lower limit is 15 per hour. So mild sleep apnea is not approved yet for treatment. And also, you have a lot of insurance require you to try the CPAP first and then fail it, and then they'll approve this kind of a device evaluation. And the last thing which we do is, before we implant anything, we send you to an ENT doctor, and he does a laryngoscopy on you while you're sleeping. It's called a sleep endoscopy, or DICE. What they do is they put you under propofol, they make you sleep, they pass the laryngoscope down your back of your nose, look at the airway, how is it collapsing? If the collapse is front to back, which is primarily tongue-related, then the device is supposed to work really well. If it's concentric collapse, which is everything is collapsing, then it may not work as well. So we have hesitation in putting a device in any of those people. Something else that you may want to think about is it's a surgical procedure. We put you under anesthesia. That's the risk of anesthesia, which goes with it. Discomfort from the surgery, discomfort from getting the infection along the course of the implant. And lastly, it doesn't start working right away. So once you implant it, the implant has to mature for a month. Then we bring you into the sleep lab. We activate the device. So remember, we are shocking your tongue to make it move forward. So you have to be able to tolerate the shock to for the machine to work. So once we turn it on, we give you a range, like lowest to maybe 10 points higher, like a 1 volt to 2 volt range. And then the patient starts with 0.1 or 0.2 volts, and then he starts titrating on his own at home until he gets to a point where he can be on a higher level. And then we bring you back in for a titration to see what voltage is right for you, and then you get the right device settings. So it's a whole process. You have to be committed to have it done. Something else which has come up lately is weight loss medications. We do know from literature from bariatric surgery, when people underwent gastric bypass, they lost a lot of weight, sometimes 100 pounds or 150 pounds. And what we were seeing in these people were that their sleep apnea got better, their blood pressure got better, they were not diabetic anymore. So the doctors looked at other ways that can make you lose weight. A lot of these diabetic medications that came out, Ozempic, Mounjaro, Zepbound, they were primarily meant for diabetes control, but then they found this effect of it that people were losing a lot of weight. So there was a big study that was done recently. It's called Surmount Trial, and they looked at people who were on CPAP but not compliant and people who were not on CPAP at all, and they gave them these medications. So over 1 to 2 years, they lost enough weight to have a 30-point difference in their apnea, hypopnea index. So some of them got cured, some of them became very mild. So there's something else that has been available on the market to help lose the weight to control the sleep apnea. Generally, if somebody is severe, I would not just go with the diet medication alone. I would probably add some treatment for the sleep apnea too, like a CPAP, while we're doing this kind of a thing. There are other options like appliances. There's medications that make you breathe better. Those are under still FDA trials to see if they're going to work or not. And lastly, general hygiene. We have them sleep better, keep a regular schedule. The more sleep deep drive you are, the more events you usually will get. That's sort of what we have right now in our armamentarium.
Well, that's very complete, and I've got some questions for you, that's for sure. In the order of things you do you start with an oral appliance? It seems like an oral appliance would be the easiest thing to try out in someone to see, other than weight loss. So, for example, someone comes in, if they're obese, do you say, listen, let's try and get some weight off and restudy you? Or is that where you start, or do you start with an oral appliance? I'm just trying to think how you approach this.
It depends upon the severity of your sleep apnea. So if you are moderate to severe, I will definitely go with the CPAP machine as a first-line treatment, because that's the gold standard, tried and tested, and it does work 99% of the time. When it doesn't work is when you cannot tolerate it. So that will be my first go-to thing for people who have got moderate to severe sleep apnea. Now, if you are mild, then I will talk to you and give you the different options and say, hey, CPAP is the best, but we also have this option of a device. We also have the option of surgical interventions. Inspire is not a conversation in mild sleep apnea patients at the time of initial presentation. Weight loss can help, but people don't lose weight right away. It takes them a while to get to a point where they will not have sleep apnea. So that's something I talk about with everybody, weight loss, whether it's calorie-restricted or exercise or seeing a weight management specialist, but it will not be the primary thing that I will do with them. Oral appliance requires you to see a dentist, and they have to create a mold for you. The device has to be fitted for you. It's, again, a titration just like Inspire device. We don't just put the device in your mouth and crank it out to the maximum protrusion. We usually will start with a 2-millimeter protrusion, and we'll gradually work on that. a lot of internet devices available too, like boil and bite devices, which the patient does it himself. Quite frankly, a lot of dentists don't like those devices because they're not molded for the patient. They develop malocclusal disease when they use it. They develop underbite if it's not the right fit. So it's an option which is available for people, but it should not be done by the patients themselves or somebody who's not familiar with the dental procedures.
So, Asher, I guess one of the things I find in patients, so I'll see patients for headache, right? And often it will coincide with the fact that they have a diagnosis of sleep apnea. So my next question is, do they use their CPAP? And to be honest with you, I got to ask you the question because usually I get a shoulder shrug at that point. They're just like, well, so what do you think from your standpoint is the percentage of people who are in compliance and use their sleep apnea device religiously from your standpoint?
Well, it's an interesting question. When CPAP came out initially, they did a trial with people of asking them how many hours they use it, and they secretly put a compliance monitor in the machine, and they looked at how many hours they were actually using it. 50% of the people were not using the CPAP if there was no help from the healthcare team. And it didn't matter what your socioeconomic status is. You could be a PhD, you could know everything about everything, and you would still not use it. It requires a lot of education for the people, a lot of support, a lot of hand-holding. A lot of our DME providers now do that. We have all our CPAP machines have a compliance monitor in them. A lot of insurances, like Medicare, will want you to use the machine for at least 4 hours per night, 70% of the time, before they will approve or purchase. It'll be a rental in the first 3 months. These people will get calls from the DME provider or from the sleep programs. Like there are certain sleep programs who have a APRN or RN dedicated to compliance monitoring. They look at the download on a real-time basis and they call the patient, hey, you're not using the machine tonight. You're not using the machine for 1 week. What's going on? Is it the mask? Is it the pressure? We can alter all these things. Now, if we do all of these things and do a comprehensive management, which we do at St. Francis, we can get a response or a compliance rate of as high as 90%. And there'll still be 10% people who will have issues, and those we can address with the second-line options for treatment of sleep apnea.
Okay. Fascinating. Now, what percentage of patients with sleep apnea actually qualify for the Inspire? Because when you watch TV, right, when you look at a commercial for Inspire, you think everybody can have this. And obviously, from what you're saying, there are a couple of factors here. One, you need to have a specific type of sleep apnea, which relates to the hypoglossal nerve and your tongue function. Mm-hmm. And two, this is not something you just hook up to somebody. They have to be dedicated to go through a process to get this Inspire. So I guess my question is, what percentage of all your patients with sleep apnea actually qualify to go through the process for the Inspire device?
So roughly half out of the top of my head, if I look at my my practice, I have like 10 people on Inspire device, and I have thousands of people coming for sleep apnea management. So it's not a big percentage. Generally, I find that these are people who are either not willing to use the machine or have a lot of complications from the CPAP. Like I had a patient who kept getting sinus infections from the CPAP. So somebody was a good candidate for this. This is not recommended for somebody who's got central sleep apnea, complex sleep apnea, heart failure-related sleep apnea. It will not work for those kinds of people. It has to be specifically obstructive sleep apnea, a certain amount of weight that they have to be in, and they have to have a frontal and backward collapse. Because I've sent a lot of people for evaluation too, and they get dinged at the point where we do the endoscopy. It's a concentric collapse. Now, they are working on another device. Inspire is a single nerve stimulator. There's dual nerve stimulators which are being put in the market too, which may work better for the concentric collapse, but we are not using that at this point in time in the clinical setting.
Asher, I got a question that came in. We didn't even get to this topic yet. I mean, this is we've been so immersed in sleep apnea, but for insomnia, do you still? This is a question from Barbara. Do you still recommend the use of melatonin? And what dose do you recommend? And I find this to be somewhat confusing in patients on melatonin because people often take it just at the time they're going to sleep, and I think that's the wrong time. Can you clarify the use of melatonin for insomnia? Do you still use it, and how do you use it?
Okay. So I will use melatonin in mild insomnia cases. For chronic and severe insomnias, it does not work very well. Generally, it works better if you have a circadian problem, too, where you have misaligned with the time cycle. The dose that is recommended in sleep literature for insomnia is between 1 to 3 milligrams. If you look at your body's melatonin level, which puts you to sleep, it's like 0.01 milligrams. So when you're taking a 1 milligram dose, that's 100 times higher than what your body needs. It has to be taken an hour or two before your bedtime, so it peaks at the time that you want to go to sleep. Melatonin is one of those hormones which regulates your sleep cycle. So if you're not aligned right, it can work in the wrong direction too. So if you take it after your maximum peak, it'll delay you even more. You'll have more difficulty falling asleep. If you take it early, then it works better. Something we use in combination with the melatonin would be the light. So you take melatonin early at night and get exposed to bright light in the morning, it sort of stabilizes your sleep schedule. I've seen people come in with 10 milligrams, 15 milligrams, 20 milligrams.
Right, right.
My thing is, if 5 doesn't work, then it's not going to work for your insomnia.
Really?
Look for help or look for some other medication or ask a sleep specialist.
That's very interesting because often most patients are taking 10 milligrams of it. So I'm glad you brought that. I'm not going to let you go until we talk about the effects of changing our clocks. You've talked a little bit about with insomnia, the cycle of our sleep. But the issue, this somewhat controversial issue, I don't think it should be a controversy, of changing our clocks twice annually and even going specifically to daylight saving time. Can you talk about how you approach this and how the Academy of Sleep Medicine looks at this?
So the Academy of Sleep Medicine came up with a position paper in conjunction with the European Biological Rhythm Society, the European Sleep Research Society, and Society for Research on Biological Rhythms in 2019. They came up with this idea that the daylight savings time is not aligned with our circadian clock. So we are making ourselves sleep delayed. When we advance the time back, we have more darkness in the morning and more light in the evening. The more light in the evening delays our time to fall asleep. The darkness prevents us from waking up at the right time. So this leads to stress for your body. So there are studies that were done to look at what does it do to your body, especially in the first month when we are switching from standard time to daylight savings time. And there's a higher incidence of problems with the heart events, myocardial infarctions, strokes, metabolic syndrome is higher, and obviously crashes are higher too. Now, we do not have data to see what will happen if you stay on daylight standard time all the time. That's something which we need to find out. But there's a lot of strain, and the position of the ASM is that circadian rhythm is more aligned with standard time, and we should not be changing it at two different times, and we should stay on standard time all year round.
Well, I really appreciate that. And Asher, I really appreciate you taking time today and clarifying so many issues on sleep apnea. For those of you listening who wish to contact Dr. Qureshi and may have a sleep disorder, you could reach his office at 860-714-4055. Asher, thanks for your time today, as always, and really thanks for the care you render to all of us in our region. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Welcome back to Healthy Rounds. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board for us. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. As always, I'll take questions during the week at info@alessimd.com. If you missed any part of today's program, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast. You just download it for free at Audacy.com or Apple Podcasts. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.